You've heard Michelle and I speak frequently about the Sagaing Hills in Upper Burma, where we created a center for Western retreats every January that we co-teach with the abbot of the monastery. A unique experiment, what we call a fusion treat, a fusion of past and present, long tradition and contemporary classical style and the modern metaphors of relevancy, ordained sangha and lay person, both lay man and lay woman, all a first in Burma. This next January will be the ninth year of that. The environment there is so palpably filled with the Dhamma that I've often used the analogy, just as when you hoist up sails in a sailing vessel, the winds fill it and off you go. You just have to navigate. In the same way, really all you have to do is go to the Sagaing Hills and hang out. And it's as if Dhamma winds are blowing all the time. There's so much inspiration in the people there, 7,000 nuns and monks and lots of lay practitioners, 700 monasteries, thousands of temples and pagodas, just the energy of 2,000 years of practice. Everything feels like a monastery there. I mean, it's all one monastery with just different little Dhamma, points or places within this 10-mile run of north to south along the Irrawaddy River, a couple of miles wide, all these rolling hills. It's more challenging in this culture, and we have to create that monastic sense and feel the winds of the Dhamma here, through our subscribing to silence and sila and samadhi, panya. Moral beauty, concentration of mind and wisdom. But it's the same idea, we want to generate in and around us an awareness that itself is our vehicle that carries us effortlessly and is just using the right tool at the right time for navigation. When the storms come up, you bring down the main sails and put up storm sails. When it's calm, you just be, but you have to be attentive to where you are all the time. And that's the idea of Dhamma practice, that, as I said before, the Dhamma, whether or not there are Buddhas, the Dhamma is. It's the truth, and it's not a truth as a belief system as opposed to another belief system that's called false. It's the truth of our own experience. What happens when the mind's quiet enough, concentrated in samadhi, and out of that silence, stillness, everything becomes apparent. We've been talking about different aspects of the four foundations of mindfulness. A lot of emphasis on the body and feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feelings, every moment of experience, it's there. And phenomena, various dhammas, the hindrances are dhammas to be known. The awakening factors, dhammas to be known. When we know hindrances, they tend to fall away. When we know awakening factors, they tend to grow strong. Mindfulness, investigative wisdom, energy, joy, calm, concentration, equanimity. Those are the awakening factors. And different ways of looking at oneself. I mentioned the five khandhas. It's the five ways to see ourselves as form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And then there's the laws of Dhamma to be known, like the Four Noble Truths, just the attunement. These are things that we study and collect as information. Yes, we hear them spoken, or we read them written, but they're meant to provide support, you know, a reference to what we experience directly. People who have never learned to read become fully enlightened just by being directed how to stay in the moment. I said I'd speak a bit tonight more on the third foundation of mindfulness. It's called citta nupassana. Nupassana is to contemplate upon, to repeatedly and carefully focus and rest one's attention on citta. Citta is the word for mind or heart. Same word for both. The center, the physical vicinity of the mind in most Asian spiritual systems is in the heart area. Not an actual organ, but, you know, some combination of this area where indeed we experience many feelings and sensations connected with the mind. Some sort of combination with that, and of course, you know, the organ of the brain that is a tool, a function of the mind's expressions. Citta is energy. Consciousness is energy. It's merely energy. It's a very subtle energy. You know, we look at the body, sensations are energy. We look at light. Light is energy, and sound is energy. And so is scent. Consciousness is the most subtle of the energies, and in many ways crucial at some point to mindfully inquire, investigate. Because of its very subtlety is where we tend to the last holdout of identification, that there's someone knowing. So consciousness, knowing are the same thing. A moment of knowing, a sight, a sound, a sensation, a thought is the same as consciousness, you know, seeing consciousness, sensation consciousness, thinking consciousness, and so forth. So all we're doing when we practice citta nupassana is bringing the factor, the magical mental formation of mindfulness turned upon consciousness of which it's a part, turned upon consciousness itself, turned upon the mind itself, so that it's the attention, rather than going toward the object of consciousness, the object of knowing, is in fact turned on to the stream of consciousness itself, the knowing itself, moment to moment. Like a thought moment, it rises and passes very swiftly. No two moments alike. No, you know, sound, we're hearing cars go by, we hear music, really pay attention. It's just units of sound and the consciousness of that sound appearing as a pair and vanishing, moment to moment. So it's an interesting exercise, you know, when we have the energy. It requires a strong and balanced energy and enough tranquility to be really relaxed. Not going to see anything if we're not relaxed, if we're tense. Can't see. It's more of a sensing. Keep in mind, you know, mind has no location. Brain isn't the mind. And even this sort of heart center is just an aspect, a physical component considered in the Buddhist psychology to be part of mind states. And, you know, you'll see people in Asia refer more to their heart center when they're saying, well, I think this. You know, here in the West, we go to the head. Well, I think this. It's just an interesting difference of conditioning. So the deep relaxation and that in-tunement of energy then allows just the right components of that more effortless attunement to the stream of knowings, watching the trail of knowings as primary, you know, anchored in that, rather than the objects of the knowing. So the knowing or noticing mind that is aware of the object, breath, sound, sensation, becomes itself the object of our attention. Sometimes the object comes up first. First we notice, you know, tightness in the leg. You feel that tightness. You feel its components. You feel its unpleasantness. And you get relaxed, calm, concentrated. Well, what is it that's experiencing, you know, that tightness and tension, vibrations? Maybe it lightens and tingles, and you're getting really used to learning how incredibly fluid and changeable sensations in the body are. Taking that same interest, turn it on what it is that is experiencing those sensations. You know, and that is the knowing mind. That is the awareness. That is the putting the attention on what is feeling, sensing, knowing, the tension and tightness. Tension and tightness are still there, but they start to recede more in the background. Something else happens. A thought arises, and we're used to noting, thinking, or remembering, or anticipating, or analyzing. Well, what is it that's knowing the thoughts? What is it that's knowing that thinking is happening? You know, what's the experiencing? The experiencing is the knowing mind, is consciousness. And we turn this special quality of mindful awareness, non-judging, non-preferential, not wanting anything, not needing the experience to be different, we turn that mindful attention onto this stream of knowings, stream of consciousness itself. No time to label that. Start labeling, you get swept away, you know, and just as soon go back then to body, you know, get grounded again. Wait again until you feel that stillness and that relaxation, no tension in the mind, no forcing. And then it's like peripheral vision. You know, we hear a sudden sound. We look out the window. We see it's a bird, sweet bird evening song. And we see the bird in the tree. Maybe we note looking first, and then we see it, and we notice seeing, and just try to connect with the visual experience rather than the concept. The actual experience is seeing. You know, so the concept of bird might fall away, and the actual experience is hearing vibration, not bird song. It's the conceptual level of mind that labels it, that names it, and you know, differentiate between the actual experience and then the interpretation, the embellished naming, of conceptual naming. But what if, while looking at the bird in the tree, we relax our gaze? We're no longer looking or seeing in a staring kind of way. We're not focused precisely on the object of sight or sound. Rather, the gaze is more diffuse around the space that surrounds the tree and the bird and fills the whole sound realm, not just focused on that particular sound vibration. You know, so there's an awareness of a visual field out there, but we're not taking that as a primary object of attention. We're aware, perhaps, of sound vibrations passing somewhere in the horizon of the sound realm, but we're not, you know, choosing to focus on just that sound. It's spread all around. But just use that metaphor to try and feed, and the subtlety of that is very similar to the feeling attention, to the feeling of the knowing mind, the feeling of citta, of consciousness. You look for it, you won't see it. But there's just the sense of knowing, because there has to be this continuous knowing in order to feel a sensation, you know, feel the breath, observe a sound, watch an emotion, feel the nature of the components of the emotion, the thoughts about it, the mental mood itself, the sensations, the feeling tone. Imagine how relaxed it is now to rest in this very subtle realm of knowing or of awareness. And moment to moment, still staying really attuned, because things can start to happen very, very swiftly. You can start to notice that the rush of physical sensations, like a stream rushing by, like the whole body might feel like vibration, and you know, just energy swirls, and very subtle tingling, like the whole body is just humming with vibration. You can't even discern the body parts. You know there's a sensation in space somewhere, in awareness, but you can't say exactly it's the knee, or the belly, or the head. And, you know, thought formations, images, very swiftly. Not time even to often know what they are. Just, I sometimes call the mental thoughts and phenomena, emotions, mental sensations. Similar to body sensations, just quite subtle, and they have a different characteristic. They're not the physical universe. They're a more subtle, mental aspect of experience. That too speeds, sounds speed along. And in fact, everything can start to see that's just arising and passing very, very swiftly. Because that's the truth of it. It's not that actually things get faster. So awareness gets more subtle. Why? Because it's paying more attention to the subtlest object of all, of our experience, the mind itself, consciousness itself. And that's why there's no time to label, and this is a sense of continuously letting go. It invites the insights quicker. It invites things to arise quicker. And it helps us to, you know, get out of feeling stuck often quicker. We learn to go with the flow of knowing rather than feeling, you know, stuck in a repeating pattern. In the ocean, there's what ocean people call a riptide. Riptide happens when there's a lot of waves that come in to the shore. That's a lot of energy and water. And because it comes in, it has to find a way out. And water, you know, tends to conform to its surroundings. So a strong collection of water going into shore, it tends to come together, and then together it goes back out. Sometimes sideways for a while, but often just straight out. Sideways for a while and then straight out. It's like a river. All this water that comes in gathers together, and it contours to the sandy bottom or the reef bottom, rocky bottom, whatever, and rushes out. If someone doesn't know what a riptide is, it's a real panicky situation, because all of a sudden you feel you know, you're just swimming, having a good time. You don't really feel it because you're one with the current. You just all of a sudden the shore seems further out and further out and further out, and then a little panic might set in and you start swimming toward the shore, but you're swimming against the rip. And at best, you just swim in place. If the rip is strong enough, you just kind of keep going out as you struggle against it. You get tired and panicky. That's when the lifeguard comes out and saves you. If you know about riptides, though, you know there's two alternatives. You can ferry across the riptide. That is, you're still kind of going out, but you use the currents to help propel you to the side. Remember, it's like a river. You know, and the river has edges. So the person who understands that they're in a rip will try to go for the edge. And then you're out of the rip. And you can swim right into shore, right next to the stream that's going swiftly in the opposite direction. Sometimes you can't do that because the rip often goes through a channel, you know, a deeper place, and then off outside of the channel can be big waves. Some people, if you can surf, then you can catch a wave, you can body surf in. If you don't like to surf or you don't know how to surf, then it's too dangerous to do that. The thing is to go with the current, because it's going to stop. You know, when it reaches a certain distance out to sea, and not too far usually, you know, and if you relax and do a little waving and a little screaming, someone will come and get you. Because very soon you'll find that you're not in the rip anymore. If you're not tired, then you can start your way in, you know, another way, or, you know, better to get a ride in from the lifeguard. Well, it's the same in practice. You know, we get stuck in these currents and these riptides in the mind, these patterns, physical patterns or emotional patterns or some complex of physical, emotional patterns, and we feel caught by it. We feel swept by it. So a skillful way of doing that deeply involves this citta nupassana, this awareness of consciousness, awareness of mind, is the equivalent of either ferrying to the side, you know, just could be very strong energy system going on with emotions and sensations and thoughts and whatnot. Use the momentum of that to kind of cut off to the side, to another object, you know, anchor somewhere else. To sounds, or better yet, the knowing of sounds. Because it's just a wider field. You know, knowing is knowing of anything. And so it can also still include this intense energy pattern that's going on, but you're suddenly on the side of it rather than caught in it. If you're caught in it, we're going to be identifying with it quite a bit. Little moments where we're not, but then again we'll identify. moments when we're not, but then we get caught. So why not step outside and have a sense that it's included in this wide spectrum of our awareness? But we just stay with the awareness. It's the awareness of this energy field of sensation, awareness of the energy emotional body that's coming up, this strong in the individual prominent emotions are, you know, in clusters. And we just, we're still the knowing of that. And likewise, you can just sort of let go in the stream of this intensity, but immediately connect with the knowing of it. Rather than going off to the side, you just switch to the awareness, anchor in the awareness of this energy, emotion, body pattern, rather than make it itself the object of your attention. Both methods are the same, but one, you are still mainly focused on that pattern that's happening, but from the perspective of the knowing of it. And the other way, you're cutting across and just being with the knowing of anything that's happening that doesn't suppress or exclude that one, but you might pay attention to the knowing of sounds, the knowing of other thoughts, other sensations, and just make space, just make some distance, a skillful distance from what's been so intense, sweeping you away. Another thing that can happen is we can be overcome by, the insights can come quite quickly when we're watching the mind. Why? Because it's so quickly changing. And because we're not spending so much time on the objects of awareness, we're just feeling the swiftness with which consciousness, you know, awareness is arising and passing. One of the insights that come up in practice is the insight into the rising, passing nature. And this is a very profound insight. It's a major turning point in practice. It's often a turning point from which we can never return because we see so deeply and in such a radically different way our experience that we just can't go back quite so strongly identified to our old patterns. You know, we can't go to sleep, the spiritual sleep that was so comforting and gave us a sense of security and identity before. You can try, but you just be more depressed. Because you've got some insights, you got a glimpse. And it gives a hit of energy, this rising and passing, a lot of brightness in the mind, a strong hit of faith, confidence. And lights can go off. You feel real centered. You feel real embodied. And at the same time, if you stay with that, is it because there's a beginning, sort of a tender, medium, and mature end of that insight, as you get more into it, things start arising and passing with more clarity, and those securities that we were used to, the slumber that gave us some respite from the intensity of you know, our life, particularly our internal life, no longer there. Then who am I? You know, or what is experience then? If all this is happening, am I hallucinating, you know? It's like you can feel like you're going a little crazy. You can feel like everything is shaky, wobbly. You can actually feel a very primal kind of fear and terror, which I like to call a Dhamma fear or terror or anxiety. You know, because of our tendency to pathologize it or associate it only with something that might have happened in our early life. It's often related, but even were we to have had perfect upbringings and families of our origin, still going to have this primal sort of existential dhamma, fear, and anxiety. Very often, as you move into these insights that are shattering to our worldview. You know, our worldview, we've spent billions and billions and billions of mind moments to create. You know, everything is just so. Everything is the objects that we see, we conceptualize them as that, we name them as that, the people are this way, and you know, numbers and languages. It's all a conceptual, created, constructed universe that we create moment to moment. Just as a collection, a gathering of all our conditioning, all our learning. They didn't start us off in kindergarten, you know, with mindfulness meditation. So what we got was a thorough conceptual orientation to life, to our experience. And that's being challenged. That is challenged when we do this practice. And when we begin to have insights like the insight of arising and passing, it is a seismic shift. It's earth-shattering at moments or at times to our attachment to our worldview, the only one we've had. And the sense of identity we hang off that, the things we do, the collection of experiences, our work, our title, our relationships, our possessions, everything is hung off of that. What happens if it starts when we see it slipping away like sand between our fingers? We can feel this terror, kind of primal, but dhamma, terror and anxiety. And that's where guidance, you know, a spiritual friend can be helpful in making that a part of our experience and so that we don't identify with it. In all the ways we learn to deal with the emotions, no matter how deep, and this kind of emotion has no content. There's not a story with it. It's nonverbal, pre-verbal, primal fear, anxiety like that. So the only thing to do is to be able to wrap our awareness around it as wide as we can make it, and feel it in the body, etc. Or to, again, just attune our attention to the awareness of that fear, that terror, that anxiety. Because we can't possibly identify. If those moments that we're connected, we connect attention to the trail of knowings, of awareness, identification is automatically dropped. It's just like a huge and spacious resting in this awareness, and confidence begins to replace the doubt and the terror and the strength, even fierceness of compassion in this work that we do, you know, overcomes the anxiety, the fear, the anxiety, the caring quality that that fills our awareness, our mindful awareness. And we can navigate through that. It's disturbing. But it's also reassuring to know that this is part of the landscape. This is actually insight. There's even other, you know, there's another later stage of misery, but it's a Dhamma misery. And it's a manifestation of an insight, a partial manifestation of an insight. And it takes us deeper as we go through it. We go through disenchantment. You know, we're hooked, we're enchanted by the beckonings of the world. We get enchanted or intimidated by it. When we're disenchanted, then the world, particularly our psychological world, the world of our experience, of our senses, no longer has that intoxicating grip on the mind or threatening grip on the mind. Time and concept fall away, often rather quickly when we're watching the mind, when our primary focus is awareness. In the beginning of practice, 5 minutes of sitting sometimes feels like 2 hours when there's discomfort, when there's pain. You know, and mind gets reactive, and of course, frustrated. Aren't they going to ring the bell? You know, their clock slow runs. You know, it's time to ring the bell. Their clock is slow. Maybe I should go up and ring it for them. And then later on, you know, you have a sitting, and you kind of hear the bell, and you sit a little longer. And by the time you get up for walking or a meal or something, you realize you've been sitting maybe an hour and 20 minutes. And it seemed like 5 or 10 minutes. Time is a concept. Space is a concept. You know, that's why sometimes everything seems altered. It feels like, you know, it's an altered consciousness. Well, it is. It's seen as it is. It's seeing things clearly. It's not so attached to formulating all our experience into a fixed object, a person out there. Things blend on the edges, you know, the hues of colors. Everything can appear like rainbows at times, and sounds meld. Or sounds sometimes feel like sensations. You may not know the difference. You know, that acute categorization that occurs by our linear conceptual mind, it gives way. You know, that can be really weird too. It can feel really strange. The body can feel like it's blowing up or being compressed. All sorts of weird things happen in the body. You know, so go to the teacher and say, you know, I might be having a heart attack, or you know, an aneurysm in my brain. And the truth is that the body goes through a huge amount of contortions. People often feel like they're going through the birth canal again, and literally, energetically, on the body level, they're re-experiencing that, the equivalent of that, the echo of that. It's a powerful practice. It's a purification practice on a molecular level. Every element of the body and mind is being shaken and cleansed. And as we start to turn our lives after insights like the arising and passing, you know, it's like there's no choice. Our lives start to get turned, like the ship at sea that slowly begins to change direction. Dhamma winds, filling the sails. Death thoughts come up because, you know, feeling the sense that everything's dissolving, nothing to hold on to. We're actually experiencing the birth of death of each moment. But it gives us a shaky feeling because there's no self to be found. There's nothing permanent to hold on to, nothing stable, nothing we can rely on. There's not a thought or, you know, it's so swiftly passing. Nothing seems reassuring. And at that moment, it's true. No phenomena is reassuring. The only thing then that can be reassuring is the truth, the Dhamma, the Dhamma itself. And the elements that support it, confidence and Dhamma energy, mindfulness, they're all very comforting. Concentration, wisdom, reverence. There's like actually a lot of them. You know, in the out of 121 different consciousness mind states, Only three of them are associated with unpleasantness, unpleasant experience. Guess where we spend a great deal of our time? It's kind of reassuring to hear things like that, and to know that practice just brings out more either these positive, wholesome, skillful states or the neutral ones. And the other ones diminish. There's a lot of unskillful states of mind that appear, but they all relate down. They all are rooted in just those few mental qualities. Our life, our all of our experience, I think I was saying this morning, is a collection of what we call mind, moment to moment. Our mind is a reflection of our life. Our life is a reflection of the mind. So the wisdom and kindness that we begin to develop through the awareness, watching the mind, watching any of the four foundations of mindfulness, body, feelings, dhammas, wisdom and kindness give our life a profundity, a foundation of depth, out of which we live, out of which our actions arise, our thoughts, our speech. The degree and depth that we see, we don't have to try and change our actions before we can do it. We have the precepts that sort of helps protect our practice of trying non-harming, But with insight, we don't need the guidelines, because the wisdom and compassion are just there. And the thoughts and actions of speech that arise out of that are incapable of intentionally causing harm. And so our lives can be completely transformed in how we respond to unpleasant stuff that happens. Doesn't mean that everything's now going to be great. It's going to be dukkha as before, minus one major thing. The dukkha that we add on to the dukkha that we meet, which is optional dukkha. Reactivity. Reactivity is such a huge part of our lives. Non-reactivity is that mindful equanimity, balance, serene balance. Non-attachment, all the same. Non-attachment, non-reactivity, equanimity, balance. That's what happens. That's what grows out of this mindfulness practice. And quite quickly, as we learn more to watch the mind itself, it's really balanced, because you really have to relax. You really have to learn to let go that efforting, striving. And you at the same time need the attunement, the energy, the courageous energy, it's called, virya in Pali. The two of those keep that poise, that equipoise of mindfulness. So equanimity is there from the beginning. Otherwise, you're cast off from watching the stream of knowings, watching the mind, which is fine. Then we come back to what we know. Come back to the breath. Prince Siddhartha, when he became an ascetic, practiced ascetic practices for 6 years, mostly self-mortifying practices and body denying. Then he got nurtured and went under the tree, the Bodhi tree, vowed to just sit until he knew, until he understood the mind in its entirety. He did it all watching the breath. He was watching the breath at the nostrils that night. Didn't waver. Just watched the breath, got very, very concentrated, very absorbed, then just turned the awareness onto the immediacy of his experience. The intense velocity with which all things were appearing and vanishing moment to moment and dissolving, and the great equanimity that came from that, that stillness, that, the immovable mind, not threatened by intimidation, not seduced by attractive objects, just there the whole time watching the breath. He said mindfulness of the body or the breath is both noble and divine, and leads to complete liberation. I was talking a bit about, you know, how death becomes such a prominent either shadow, you know, it's kind of lurking in the sidelines of there's nothing to grab onto, what is there, or it comes right up like a realization of how impermanent we are. And that there is no question that of our own death and everyone else's. And so without deeper insights, and you know, without going through those painful states and misery and disenchantment and the equanimity, we won't have the understanding, you know, to be able to live fearlessly with the awareness of death. We're all capable of it. Often children, you know, already have that knowledge. They forget it, but they have it. I was living in the mountains, the foothills of the Himalayas in India in the 70s, with my daughter. She was two. I was a single parent. And I went with friends. We rode on a motorcycle down from the 7,700-foot hill station we were living at. And we went down to Rishikesh, where the Ganges River flows. And then we went above that, north of that, to Lakshmanjula. This is like really a long time ago, and it's quite remote then. Stayed there for a while, stayed there for a few days, and the water's very clean where it rushes out of the Himalayan gorge there, you know, out of the Tibetan steppes. And so we went swimming. We'd go swimming and, you know, there's a little beach there, really quite nice in the heat of the day. One day we're swimming, and then Chandra, my daughter, was walking on the beach, and then by some rocks, and she, you know, called me over, "Daddy, Daddy, look!" Came over, and there was a, you know, half buried, burned skeleton. You know, the tradition is in Hindu life is burn the body, crack the skull. Soul goes out and throw it into the river. And that happens largely quite south, like around Varanasi, but a bit in the mountains, in the hills. So there it was, sort of half buried, and you could see its skull, its teeth, cracked open, cranial shell and whatnot. And we just sort of stood there silently. I didn't say a thing. And Chandra was wonder-eyed, kind of staring at it. I don't know what, it was timeless. I don't know how long we were there. But after a while, she turned, she looked up, said, "Daddy, when you die, you just throw it away." I said, "Yeah." She said, "Oh." And we went back swimming. You know, it could be a real traumatic experience in the West. I've mentioned how wherever we anchor our awareness, whether it's in the body, feelings, the mind, our awareness itself, or phenomena, dhammas, which is also very subtle. And as Michelle often says, try to be in that sort of active receptivity, active in that we're real alert and attuned just to the moment, because we can only know the moment. But receptive, meaning let the objects come forward. And of course, this is especially true in the citta nupassana, attention, mindfulness of the mind. Because we're not watching objects, we're watching the awareness of them, we're watching the knowing of them. So here it's entirely in the realm of the knowing mind that we're anchored, that we're attending to. But there's the noticing of all the other objects coming forward. We're just not going to them. We're just not noticing, we're not noting or noticing particularly that sound, that sensation. We're aware of them, you know, arising like a star and setting again in the dome of our awareness, like a real quick star, you know, fast forward, up and gone, like that. That receptivity also is helpful in not identifying with experience. You know, we're receiving the emotion, no matter how ecstatic or how painful. We're receiving it in awareness. It's not us. It's impermanent. It's not a going forward into it, like I have to investigate this. Even the subtle little thought, oh, I should look at this. You know, it's just, it's back to how we create our moment-to-moment conceptual universe. And just letting go of that. Really trying to let go of that. Things come forward into awareness. Not try to do anything. When we find that we let go our trying, that we'll find we're already here. We're already present. One of my very first teachers in Buddhism was a Zen martial artist from China who came to the University of Hawaii, where I was attending college in the 60s. He taught different martial art forms. I never knew what he knew. First, I was doing a martial art called Ying Yi, like five elements thing. And then later, this other thing called Pa Kwa, which is, if you know anything about the I Ching, it's eight movements that are connected to the hexagrams of the I Ching. And it takes 2 hours to go around one circle. And you're just a sweating, drenched being after doing that. You know, and then when I was sick, after 2 years of doing this stuff, I learned you did acupuncture. And then later on, they did Tai Chi, which I really loved. In all these years, you know, he saw me studying all this stuff, reading all this stuff on consciousness, you know, books on all the contemplative practices, East and West. And sometimes I'd ask him questions. And one day we were finished practicing Tai Chi. I was outside, a big stack of books in my arms, and he was kind of looking at them. And he looked at me and he just smiled. And I was in a real relaxed, open place after Tai Chi. And he said, Stephen, be careful of chasing your own shadow all your life. There's no mokchi. It was the Hindi word for liberation. There is no mokshi. There's only now. You know, and it was a way of saying, don't be goal-oriented after all this stuff and all these, you know, I was just voraciously reading every spiritual book I could get my hands on. And it just said, there's no mokshi. There's only now. And it didn't cause me to stop reading, but it surely changed my attitude, you know, and it just oriented me more that it was about practice. And one can have the vision of liberation, you know, the vision of a shining heart of love and compassion. But one must be in the moment, must be able to navigate the sailing ship so that the winds of Dhamma can, you know, take you to the other shore. Sorry, it's all I have time for. I'll finish this talk in the fall. But I will read a poem. It's a bit long, but it's really good. It's another poem by David White. And I think there's a lot in here about just what I talked about tonight. In terms of utilizing all of our experience, the painful stuff, the whole collection, the whole lot of who we are for our benefit, you know, for our awakening, harnessing the flow of things, whether it's the mind or the hindrances, the difficulty, the pain, and finding balance in that. You know, the balance is the key. Balance makes our mind like bamboo. Its very strength is in its vulnerability. Bamboo, you know, Asian and Hawaiian bamboo, very big, very tall, but even a hurricane rarely breaks it because it's hollow inside. And the outer core, the outer thing, it's a grass, so I don't know what you call it. Bamboo is a grass family thing. It yields. It bends. And no matter how far it bends over one side or the other side, its nature is to come back to center. Bamboo mind is what we're cultivating here. So this poem's called The Faces of Braga. In monastery darkness, by the light of one flashlight, the old shrine room waits in silence. The old shrine room waits in silence. Often David White repeats some of his lines. While above the door, we see a terrible figure, fierce eyes demanding, will you step through? As the old monk leads us, bent back, nudging blackness, prayer beads in the hand that beckons, we light the butter lamps and bow, eyes blinking in the pungent smoke. Look up without a word. See faces in meditation, 100 faces carved above, eye lines wrinkled in the handheld light. Such love in solid word. Wood. Such love in solid wood. Taken from the hillsides and carved in silence, they have the vibrant stillness of those who make them. Engulfed by the past, they have been neglected. But through the smoke and darkness, they are like the flowers we have seen, growing through the dust of eroded slopes, their slowly opening faces turned toward the mountain. Their slowly opening faces turned toward the mountain. Carved in devotion, their eyes have softened through age, and their mouths curve through delight of the carver's hand. If only our own faces would allow the invisible carver's hand to bring the deep grain of love to the surface, if only we knew as the carver knew, how the flaws in the wood that his searching chiseled to the very core, we would smile too and not need faces immobilized by fear or the weight of things undone, and not need faces immobilized by fear or the weight of things undone. When we fight with our failings, we ignore the entrance to the shrine itself and wrestle with the guardian fierce figure on the side of good. And as we fight, our eyes are hooded with grief and our lips are dry with pain. If only we could give ourselves to the blows of the carver's hands, the lines in our faces would be the trace lines of rivers feeding the sea where voices meet, praising the features of the mountain, the cloud, and the sky. The lines in our faces would be the trace lines of rivers feeding the sea where voices meet, praising the features of the mountain, the cloud, and the sky. Our faces would fall away until we, growing younger to our death every day, we would gather all our flaws in celebration to merge with them perfectly, impossibly, wedded to our essence, full of silence from the carver's hands. Our faces would fall away until we, growing younger to our death every day, we would gather all our flaws in celebration, to merge with them perfectly, impossibly, wedded to our essence, full of silence from the carver's hands.